First case that we have set for argument is Banner Bank versus First American Title Insurance. Counsel, we're ready for your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, Scott Geiser on behalf of Appellant First American Title Insurance Company. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The district court's order entering summary judgment in favor of Banner Bank should be reversed, and summary judgment should be entered in favor of First American for two reasons. The first, the complaint filed by the receiver alleged a single theory of liability, which was for violation of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. And second, because there was only a single theory of liability, that theory of liability fell neatly within exclusion 6 of the Banner Bank's policy, which excludes all claims from coverage for fraudulent transfers. As a result, there was no duty to defend nor a duty to indemnify on the part of First American, and summary judgment should have been entered for First American. In addition to this, there's a second issue on appeal regarding a granting of attorney's fees. The order granting attorney's fees should be vacated for several reasons. First being that consequential damages and attorney's fees were not prayed for in the fourth cause of action for breach of the implied covenant, nor was there any evidence submitted as to the amount of the attorney's fees in the summary judgment papers. And lastly, the fee motion that was ultimately filed by the bank was outside the 14-day time periods set forth in Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 54 and Local Rule 54. I'd first like to address, though, the issue regarding summary judgment on the duty to defend, because that is the main issue on appeal here. Summary judgments orders are reviewed de novo. The district court found a duty to defend in this case by reading a single allegation in the receiver complaint, which is paragraph 9, which you can find at page 116 of volume 1 of the appendix. And that allegation simply states that the receiver disputes the validity of the deed of trust. Nothing more. The court then reasoned that multiple reasons could exist for why a deed of trust could be invalid, some that fall within exclusion 6 and some that fall outside of exclusion 6, and therefore there was a potential for coverage and therefore a duty to defend. But in reaching that result, the court basically disregarded well-established law for how you determine a duty to defend. In Utah, they follow the eight corners rule, which means that you compare the four corners of the complaint with the four corners of the policy, and on that basis alone, decide whether or not there's a duty, and you do not consider extrinsic evidence. When looking at the complaint, though, and following the four corners rule, you have to read the complaint as a whole. That's just basic interpretation law, statutory construction, contract, whatever. You review the complaint as a whole. You don't read allegations in isolation. And in this case, if you read paragraph 9 and then you read the allegations that precede it and then follow it, it becomes very clear what is being alleged. The paragraph 8 right before states that the bank did not put any restrictions on the funds that were to be used by Mr. Jacobson. And then it gives a parenthetical where it states that i.e. the funds were not used to improve the properties, nor were they used for any other legitimate purpose. Now, this is a flag to a fraudulent transfer claim. Why? Because a fraudulent transfer claim involves the element that the debtor did not receive anything of reasonably equivalent value and that the transfer wasn't made or was made with the intent to hinder, defraud, or delay. If it's not used to improve the properties or for some other legitimate purpose, that would eat one of the elements of fraudulent transfer.
You're citing the complaint rather than the amended complaint.
And the amended complaint it has the same allegation. For one point, the amended complaint was actually never tendered to First American, but the amended complaint doesn't change the causes of action. I believe it just added this other deeds of trust. So you get to the same result. And the reason I'm addressing the original complaint is because that's all that First American ever possessed to analyze the duty. You then go to what follows paragraph 9, and the very next thing after paragraph 9 is the header for the single cause of action alleged, which is violation of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. And then you have the subsequent paragraphs that are just allegations to meet the various elements. So when you read the complaint as a whole, it's very obvious why the trustee is saying that the deed of trust is invalid, The trustee is saying that the deed of trust is invalid because it's a fraudulent transfer. That then brings it right within the scope of Exclusion 6, which has only been interpreted on two occasions, but both cases which we cite in our case, the Concept Drosser's case out of Washington, as well as the Hanks decision, which just came out from Tennessee, both say that Exclusion 6 was meant to exclude from coverage fraudulent transfer claims. We also cite the treatise on title insurance that discusses the same result, and the reason being that fraudulent transfers are something that can't be underwritten by a title company. That's a risk that a title company could never assess. That's something that the lender can assess because they're the one that's dealing directly with the borrower, and so it makes sense that these types of claims would be excluded. The bank then tries to save the district court's ruling by referring to two other items, the reconsideration letter that they sent, as well as the settlement agreement between the bank and the receiver. In the reconsideration letter, the bank seems to conclude that because the allegations fall within a covered risk, that must mean that there's coverage regardless of the exclusion, but the insuring provisions are very clear that they're all subject to the exclusion. So while the allegations might fall within a covered risk, they are still excluded from coverage because they fall within Exclusion 6.
Could First American have investigated a little bit so that we're not having this discussion and simply looked into what the trustee or the receiver was talking about when the receiver said invalid?
No, for two reasons. First, it's plainly clear from the four corners of the complaint what was being alleged, and the four corners rule says you don't do that. You don't look at extrinsic evidence. You just look what is before you. And if you look at the reconsideration letter, Maury Hawkins, who was the second claims counsel to review it, she says plainly and follows Utah law and says, based upon the four corners of the complaint, there's only one theory being alleged here, and that's for fraudulent transfer. And that also falls within the conditions of the policy, which states that First American will only defend against those stated causes of action in the complaint. And it's in unambiguous terms that must be enforced. It's a contract between the party that is clear on its face is what is meant. The settlement agreement that then is referred to doesn't change the result. Again, that is something that falls outside of the four corners of the complaint and the policy. But if you look at the settlement agreement itself, again, if you read the allegations as a whole or the recitals as a whole, you reach the same result. The settlement agreement starts on page 100 of volume 1 of the appendix, and there are two paragraphs that matter. There's paragraph D and paragraph G. G is where the terms or the term conveyed without authorization appears, but if you look at recital D, it's a recital of the fact that the receiver filed a complaint for an avoidance claim. Now, why is that significant? Because fraudulent transfer claims are part of what are termed as avoidance claims. So it's just a signal, again, to this is a UFTA claim. Then if you look at the actual full paragraph G, and I'll just quote it, it says, the receiver has asserted in the litigation that Jacobson was managing various businesses as a Ponzi scheme, and that the trustee deeds conveyed to secure the line of credit established by American West were conveyed without authorization by the trustors, making those conveyances, and that the conveyance was part of an overall and continuing fraud operative by Jacobson and the companies managed and controlled by him. So both before and after the words conveyed without authorization are words about fraud, Ponzi scheme, fraudulent transfer. So again, read the whole thing as a whole. We understand why it is that it was said that the trustee's deeds or the deeds of trust were done without authorization because they were part of a Ponzi scheme. And if you...
Let me ask you a question about timing on this.
Sure.
So do you know if the settlement agreement between the bank and the receiver was executed before or after your denial of coverage?
After.
After.
Yes.
Okay. So is that after both of them or after your first denial?
It was after both. And if you note in the reconsideration, there isn't any mention of a settlement agreement. So it was something that, again, the settlement agreement was something brought up after the fact, not before or part of the actual coverage determination. So getting back to the terminology that's being used here of unauthorized conveyance, that's something if you actually search nationwide on cases involving fraudulent transfer claims, that's common terminology. I can point to the Scholes versus Lehman case, which is out of the Seventh Circuit, 56 F3rd 750. That was a case discussing a uniform fraudulent transfer case involving a Ponzi scheme. And at page 754, the Seventh Circuit notes that assets were removed from the corporation for an unauthorized purpose and making that a fraudulent transfer. There's a case, Weon versus Dancing, out of the 11th Circuit, Fed 578, Fed Appendix 938, again discussing a Ponzi scheme and noting that fraudulent transfers occur when assets are transferred without an unauthorized purpose. And lastly, there's May versus Williams out of Missouri, 531 SW 3rd 576, again discussing fraudulent transfers under Missouri's Fraudulent Transfer Act, and stating that when a person makes an unauthorized distribution or transfer with actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud, it's a fraudulent transfer. So the word unauthorized is commonly used when referring to fraudulent transfer claims.
So looking at the policy where it says failure to of any person or entity to have authorized a transfer conveyance, you're reading authorized to mean that you're a legitimate person with the company keys or you have the authority as a member of the organization to make the transfer?
Well, I wouldn't say that, because the first thing that you do is, and when analyzing coverage, is you first look at if there's coverage.
Okay, well, let me just ask you this then, and maybe it'll shorten it a little bit. Do you contend that Mr. Jacobson had authority to make a transfer or conveyance on behalf of the companies?
No, we're not contending he had authority.
Are you saying that he didn't have authority?
Correct. And we acknowledge that. And again, that's why when we do the analysis, the allegation falls within the covered risk. But then you have to look at the exclusions and say, okay, does what is being alleged, though, fall within one of the exclusions that would then take it out of coverage? So that's why you have to ask the question of why. Why was it an unauthorized transfer? Why was it an unauthorized conveyance? And that's where you get your answer in the complaint. And it tells you that it's a fraudulent transfer. That's why it's unauthorized. And then that falls within Exclusion 6.
Are you saying that an authorized person could not make a fraudulent conveyance?
Well, it depends on how you're talking about authorized. And this is
I'm talking about authorized the way that the policy is talking about.
The policy talks about it being an unauthorized transfer. And you can have... or did it without authority is actually the words used. And you can do something without authority for multiple reasons. If you want to, I see Your Honor shaking your head.
Let me just read it. It
sure.
says failure of any person or entity to have authorized a transfer or conveyance.
Right. And so there's multiple reasons that something like that can occur. You can have either the person wasn't, like in this case, we're dealing with an LLC. Were they not a member? Were they not a manager that had the authority to do that? Was it a forgery? I mean, there's a host of reasons for why it could be. And that's why, again, the first step in the analysis is, okay, the allegation falls within an insuring risk, but then the second step is, does it fall within an exclusion? And here, yes, it does.
That sounds like you changed your answer to me, that you think now that he was authorized, because it wasn't a forgery, because he was the whatever of the companies...
No.
He was authorized in that sense.
He was authorized, again, he's authorized in the sense that he is the manager, but he is not authorized to make fraudulent transfers. That's the position. That's why the lack of authority occurs, is because no one is allowed to make a fraudulent transfer. You don't have authority to do that.
Why can't he be authorized and then you exclude it because it's a fraudulent transfer?
That's exactly right. Because here's the thing. If he was authorized, then you wouldn't have a covered risk. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like if you said he was authorized, then we don't fall within an insuring provision. If that was the position of First American, then it wouldn't fall within any of the insuring provisions, and you would never get to the exclusions.
If you wanted to reserve time, you better take it now.
Okay. All right. Are we at the... Oh, yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Troy Boer on behalf of Banner Bank. There's a distinction that the district court drew that First American is refusing to draw that explains why its case law and its theory don't work here. And the distinction is this. Certainly, the using of property by an entity of Mr. Jacobson for a personal loan of money that went straight into the pocket of Mr. Jacobson. With regard to transfers of his entities, there can be fraudulent transfers because there's not reasonably equivalent value. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the bank. Did the bank provide reasonably equivalent value? Absolutely. Their lien on property was equivalent to the loan amount. If we're focusing on the transaction with the bank, then only a cursory review of this complaint and the statutes that were cited in the complaint would lead to the answer that the district court concluded here. Utah Code Section 2569, subsection 1, the 2012 version, it's the very thing cited in part of the complaint. It says a transfer or obligation is not voidable against a person who took in good faith for reasonably equivalent value. If we're talking about the bank took in good faith for reasonably equivalent value, extended a loan for exactly the amount of the lien. What was the fraudulent transfer? Between all of Mr. Jacobson's entities. The Fraudulent Transfer Act could not. By the time you get to the settlement, there's a good reason why the Fraudulent Transfer Act is not the basis of liability. Because it could not possibly be the basis of liability as a matter of law as to the transaction with the bank.
Well, you're arguing against the merits, seems like. Can we talk about the title insurance policy? How do you get there? How do you get coverage?
Absolutely. There's two provisions there. And one of them is transferring without authority, and the other is based upon fraud. You cannot read the exception to mean anytime you transfer without authority, then it's a fraudulent transfer and the exception swallows the rule.
Well, let me reverse that on you, because first of all, let me ask you this. Was Mr. Jacobson authorized to make the transfer or conveyance?
The finding is no. No, he wasn't authorized. And if you look at the complaint and you look at the settlement, there is risk and liability to the insured, but it's not because of a fraudulent conveyance.
Well, here's my problem that maybe you can help me with, which is that title insurance, the company is insuring something, and what it's insuring is something that it has an ability to control or to learn. And so to the extent that you had someone come in and say they were someone, the president of the company and sign or something, title insurance company can protect that. But if it's a Ponzi scheme, the title insurance company wouldn't have any idea how to do that. And so tell me why this reading's bad. That indeed Mr. Jacobson had authority to go to the bank and sign papers, but if he fraudulently conveyed, the exclusion applies. Otherwise, the exclusion is just written completely out of the contract.
No, Your Honor, I mean, first of all, I would say that the line between what a title company can detect and what it can't detect is not the line that this policy tracks. They cover for forgery, for undue influence, for fraud. And so those are all things that title companies cannot detect, and those are absolutely covered under this policy. So that's not the line that the policy is tracking.
Wait a minute. Fraud is not covered under the
policy. Fraud is covered under the policy.
Well, it's excluded.
No. Fraudulent conveyance, a specific way of avoiding an otherwise valid transfer, is excluded. Fraud is expressly covered. Only fraud that leads to the technical term fraudulent conveyance is excluded under the policy. Not fraud, not forgery, not undue influence, not transferring without authorization. All of those are covered. The carve-out is just brought under a specific statutory scheme involving fraudulent conveyance.
Well, the title insurance company can check and make sure that the person who is in the office wanting to sign is indeed the president. There are all sorts of things it can do in that regard. But there's nothing it can do to alert itself to a Ponzi scheme.
Nor can they do anything about undue influence. Nor can they do anything about making somebody sign under duress.
What part of the policy are you referring to? For
the very provisions at JA 358 is where they are. You've got subsection A, which provides coverage for
forgery, fraud, undue duress, and the very next subsection B is failure of any person or entity to have authorized a transfer or conveyance. And so those are covered. The exception comes later only if it's a fraudulent conveyance, because most of the time that happens in bankruptcy. And that's the carve-out that's in their policy. So how do we know that by the time we get to the settlement agreement, it doesn't have anything to do with fraudulent conveyance?
Well, let's talk about, I mean, what's your authority for the being able to consider the settlement agreement in determining whether there was coverage?
Because the duty to indemnify is triggered only by the settlement agreement. He's talking about the duty to defend. That's at the time of the complaint. The duty to indemnify is the actual basis of liability for the insured by which they paid money covered under this policy? Absolutely yes. Because this settlement agreement is not based upon a fraudulent conveyance. It could not be as a matter of Utah law, because the bank acted in good faith and provided reasonably equivalent value. The fraudulent conveyance, which is the only carve-out here, could not apply as a matter of law, which is why it's not the basis.
Well, you're claiming they had a duty to indemnify also, aren't you?
Absolutely, and so okay. The court found that as well.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So what concerns me about the settlement, but you're today not saying that the settlement agreement has anything to do with that analysis.
Which analysis?
With the duty to indemnify.
It embodies the duty to indemnify. It doesn't have anything to do with the duty to defend.
Okay, so let me back you up then. So the duty to defend. So your argument to us is not that the settlement agreement matters at all with respect to the duty to defend.
Except in this inferential sense is that First American has rightly pointed out that the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. We get to the end of this lawsuit, and the only basis for liability is not a fraudulent conveyance, but yet it's based upon that original complaint. And so the basis that turns out to be the actual basis for liability of the insured was brought to the surface throughout the litigation. It's contained in the complaint. It's explained to First American in the letter that the bank writes to First American. And it turns out to be the actual basis of liability at the end of the lawsuit. And because the duty to defend, under Utah law, it is triggered if you have a complaint that is vague, that is ambiguous. If there is anything unclear about it, you defend. And if you think that you don't have a duty to defend, you file a deck action and you get a court to say you don't, and then you get out. That's the way that you do it if there's anything vague in the complaint. Here, not only was there something vague in the complaint, it was pointed out directly to First American, who never provided any analysis, never said we looked at that as a basis. And the court here, the district court, Joint Appendix 3198, it was a Ponzi scheme, but the Ponzi scheme insolvency presumption didn't even apply. Do you want to know why? Because at 3231 of the joint appendix, the investors got 94 to 95 cents on the dollar. Once the judge got into it, it wasn't really even a full-blooded Ponzi scheme. The insolvency presumption didn't apply. What was going on? 3202 of this record, alter ego. Jacobson was treating all these entities as if they were owned. I'm the managing partner of a law firm. If I go to a bank and get a line of credit based upon and use the accounts receivable as the collateral, but I go and use the money to go on vacation myself, that's not a fraudulent, it might be a fraudulent transfer between me and the law firm, but not with a bank. The bank gave value for the collateral. It is not a fraudulent transfer. Now,
let's keep talking about your settlement agreement for a minute, because what's concerning me about it is that settlement agreement occurs after you guys had received a denial of the duty of your request for indemnification and in defense. And it looks to me like it's a clever way after you get that letter to try to get something in the record somewhere saying that the case was that the that Jacobson was an unauthorized person. And when you don't get that from the complaint, to me, there's the comment in the complaint about it being unauthorized is just stray. I'm not even sure it could survive a motion to dismiss if someone actually knew that was the claim. And so it just seems like this is sort of a backdoor way to get some language in that's not apparent anywhere else.
Your Honor, I might agree with you if fraudulent conveyance were even a conceivably plausible theory at the time of the settlement. Utah Code 2569, subsection 1, a transfer or obligation is not voidable under 25651A, which is with an intent to hinder delay, which is exactly what was alleged, right? Who took in good faith for reasonably equivalent value.
Right. There's, now we're back to your first argument about this is the bank we're talking
that's
about.
That's right. Yeah. We're talking about the bank. So there's a reason the settlement agreement is put together this way. It's not a pretext. It's not trying to pull one over. It's not trying to get this for the first time in the record. It is the only basis for liability. And it's not the first time it's in the record. It was in the letter to First American Title. It is in the allegations. First American Title just told you that he was unauthorized to transfer the property and to encumber it the way that he did.
Right. Your theories on why he was unauthorized, though, are different.
Absolutely. And if there are any of those theories that are conceivable at the time of the complaint, the duty is to defend until they're no longer conceivable. That is Utah law. And let me point out that they've basically conceded this many times below and in their brief. When talking about the implied covenant, Your Honor?
Let me stop you for a second about the authorization stuff. I mean, the paragraph is, the receiver disputes the validity of the deed of trust securing the line of credit.
And the paragraph before has to do with Mr. Jacobson securing it and taking the funds for his own personal use and not going to the entity. He's not authorized to do that.
It does, but nowhere in here does it say Mr. Jacobson wasn't authorized to do this. I mean, it's not a direct allegation.
If the deed's invalid, then whoever encumbered it couldn't possibly have had authority to do so, Your Honor.
I mean, and but you could be getting there based on First American's theory that it's invalid because it was a Ponzi scheme and
no,
it was fraudulent,
Honor.
And he
absolutely
didn't have authority
not.
To do it.
That is the transfer between the entity and Jacobson and the other entities.
So you're saying the bank is protected regardless?
Absolutely. They provided reasonably equivalent value and they acted in good faith.
Well, they could have called up and talked to some people and to see if he had cleared it with their limited.
They could have.
Parties.
They could have had a duty, but they that's didn't. Not what. But that's not what good faith requires here.
But that's what the policy might require.
Yeah. And Your Honor, even if that's conceivable, that turns Utah law on its head. The duty to defend comes into being if it is conceivable that that is not the case.
Well, the duty to defend under the 8-point rule is broader than the duty to indemnify.
Absolutely.
And so if there's no duty to defend, is there a duty to indemnify?
There could be if there's an amendment along the way and not a tendering. I mean, you could conceive of circumstances where it could happen. But here, the fact that the duty to indemnify is satisfied and is based upon the very complaint
well, it's
that was
satisfied
provided,
based on the settlement agreement.
Absolutely. That's
which
all that could satisfy.
Which had nothing to do with the complaint.
But the
exclusions.
The duty to indemnify is determined entirely upon the actual basis for liability at the end of the lawsuit. The duty to defend is determined by the complaint and any conceivable exposure to the insured at the time
well,
of the
Well, it's
complaint.
Not any conceivable exposure that you could imagine. It's got to be within the four corners of the complaint.
Yeah, but Your Honor, here's Utah law. You have a duty to defend when the complaint is indefinite, vague, or ambiguous.
Well,
at
what's
least
indefinite,
until
vague, or ambiguous about this complaint that suggests that it violates the Uniform Voidable Transactions Act?
That
is a wide-scale Ponzi scheme. The only way you can look at it is it's a fraudulent conveyance.
You're right. Well, I don't think it's the only way you can look at it, but I am not denying that those things are in there. But let me explain First American Title's view at this point and how it bears directly on that issue. When addressing the implied covenant claim in this very lawsuit, below and before this court, they are confused about the legal implication of this, but they are absolutely correct when they make this statement. Quote, coverage for the bank's claim was fairly debatable, end quote. Reply at 4. There existed a debatable reason for the denial of the claim, end quote. Reply at 22. This happened below at 1694. They say there's a question of fact as to whether there was coverage. If it's fairly debatable whether there's coverage, That's what triggers coverage. It's not a defense. That's like defending against a summary judgment on qualified immunity by coming up and saying the law was unclear as to whether the officer violated the Constitution. That's not a defense to qualified immunity. That triggers qualified immunity.
Counsel,
if it's fairly debatable...
Are you wrapping up your overtime?
I am. I'm sorry, Your Honor. If it's fairly debatable, then there was a duty to defend as a matter of law under Utah law. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I have a question before you get started.
You can.
He just said something to the effect that you admitted below that there was a question of fact, and there was also some discussion whether the language was talking about using the term fairly debatable. Did you ever use the did you ever concede before the district court that there was a question of fact? Did you use those words?
No, we use the term fairly debatable because that's a bad faith response, but yeah. By no means did we ever concede that there was an issue of fact. I do want to raise two very quick points. One, and I think this kind of sums up the whole thing, I have yet to hear what the other theory of liability was. What other theory of liability was there for why this deed of trust was invalid? I have yet to hear the explanation. That it's never happened. That's because the only theory has ever been fraudulent transfer. And Your Honor hit on it. What they seem to be arguing is a merits-based issue, but that doesn't have anything to do with whether or not there's a duty to defend. Maybe it's a bad claim. That doesn't matter. It's the only theory of liability. And if you actually go to the settlement agreement, it will explain, in some level, the settlement agreement, because the amount of the insurance and the amount of deeds of trust here was $5 million. The settlement agreement was for $675,000. What does that tell you? What they said, it may have been a bad theory of liability, and so they settled at a significant discount, but that was the only theory of liability ever advanced. And the only other thing that I wanted to hit on was the question about, well, it also covers for forgery, undue influence, and fraud, and I think it was discussed, but I just want to hit. That is something can be controlled by the title company because of how these transactions happen. They either go through an escrow or they go through a settlement agent who is charged with checking IDs, making sure that the person understands what it is they're signing. So these are, again, things that can be underwritten. Ponzi scheme cannot.
I need to be fair with the time. So
thank
I
you.
Need you to wrap up as well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both for your arguments.